All right. So, as usual, let's start with your comments. You've read the chapter, which is partly about life extension and its implications, and partly about pharaonic suspension and its implications. And I wanted to get your comments, and then I've got a bunch of quiz questions for you, because I'm curious as to how you as people react to the various hypothetical choices you might have to make in a future where some of these technologies existed. But to start with, are there things you wanted to talk about from the chapters that intrigue you or you wanted to ask about or say something about? Yes?
I just didn't understand the part of the theory about how you would be thawed once you're frozen.
The current theory is first that we freeze you in a way designed to minimize the damage done. And it is currently the case, I gather, that they can freeze some individual organs and still have them usable later. I think that's a current technology, less exotic than cryonic suspension, and with lots more money put into it for obvious reasons. And then when they thaw you, they have to have some way of undoing whatever damage they weren't able to prevent. And the limiting case of that, which we'll be getting to in a little while with nanotechnology, is the idea that if you could design things at the atomic scale, you could make a sort of a robot submarine much smaller than a human cell. And you take a whole lot of those and you turn them loose in your body and they fix everything that's wrong. And that sort of would be the upper case of intervention. But short of that, there are creatures, I'm pretty sure that some amphibians can freeze and then be revived. I think frogs can naturally. And so presumably it's got to be some combination of getting better and better at minimizing the damage along with getting better and better at repairing whatever damage has happened. Now something I don't remember, I don't think I even mentioned in the chapter, but currently there are actually two options, at least with the best known people who do this. And one of them is whole body suspension and one of them is head suspension. And the head suspension, the implicit theory, is that by the time they know enough to revive you, they'll know enough to grow a new body. And it's only your brain that's you, so to speak. And therefore the argument is that you could, and the claim is that your chance of success, assuming you could grow a new body, are higher with just the head, because it's easier the smaller the amount of you is involved to cool it in a controlled way which minimizes damage. So the basic idea for that tactic is the critical thing for preserving you is your brain. The rest we can replace by that time. So it's an optimistic view of the future, but I think not an absurdly optimistic view of the future. And that costs substantially less, of course, than whole body. And some people think it's actually more likely to work than whole body, though we don't know that. Other comments, questions, things people don't understand? All right, well, let's try using you as experimental subjects then. So let's start with the easiest version. Assume that you could either stop aging or assuming that you're old enough so that you're getting decrepit, reverse aging back to some reasonably healthy state of life, and then stay alive for a very long time. Would people choose to do so? How many people are reasonably confident that given the option, they would do it?
We have to do both.
What?
Do we have to do both?
But you can do it at your present age.
Reverse aging and extend life?
No, assuming you've got the option. So if you like the way you are at the moment, you just extend life. You just stop aging. If you say, well, I'm a little bit young. I'll really be a better person at 45 than I am now. You wait till 45 and then stop aging. If you say, well, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit creaky and my joints hurt and my eyesight is beginning to go, then they say, all right, pick an age. We'll run you back to that age, and then your biological state will be frozen there. So I'm just assuming the sort of the fully developed version of which you can completely control what physical age you're at and then stop getting older. And the question is whether people would do it. And we've got... So I want... Yes, you would. All right. So I think the reason that people would do it seemed pretty obvious to me, but I'm curious if any people who aren't confident they would do it can explain why they might not do it. Because that seems a more interesting question. Yes?
I might not, just because I assume it would be for a certain amount of time, not like forever.
Assume you keep doing it. You know,
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I think assuming you can keep doing it, I think you'll run into a lot of problems you see in like vampire and all like that, where people get bored with life having lived forever.
So what you're saying now is that you think you would do it, but you probably want to keep doing it forever.
Yeah, maybe like double the maximum current lifespan.
This reminds me of my general thesis about at what point money becomes useless. And that is that practically everybody in the world believes there's some level of income above which additional expenditure is just wasteful luxury. And just about everybody believes that level of income is roughly twice his own. And that's a generalization. I think it roughly describes how people act. That all of us are fabulously wealthy by the standards of 150 years ago. If you think about the options we've got. I mean, if you think about the fact that you can have a symphony orchestra perform for you while you're walking down the street with nobody else hearing it at demand, and compare that. I mean, there weren't kings who could do that. They could do it, but it would take some time and organization. They have to sit where the orchestra was and so forth, aside from, you know, medical and other things that you do. And yet most of us feel as though we'd like to be a little richer. And I wonder if the same phenomenon isn't here true, that given that you've adjusted your expectations to a lifespan of, if you're very lucky, 100 years, you say, well, 200 is all anybody could possibly want. But maybe if everybody was getting 200 and was used to thinking of those terms, well, I'm going to run out of time, I better get 400. I don't know. That's pure guesswork. But I think you're raising a legitimate issue, and that's trying to imagine what your life would be like. And we know that there are occasionally people who conclude that life isn't worth living. And some of them are people who are in terrible pain or things of that sort. But some of them aren't. I don't know if I've commented before, but my mother's comment after my father died was that the one thing she was unhappy about in her life was she hadn't died at the same time he did. And she wasn't in pain. She was in, she was in her 90s, so she was physically frail, but she was functional, her mind was still working, her memory hadn't gone, and yet she just didn't want to be alive, although she wasn't willing to do anything about it. So that's one possibility, that might happen. And I don't know how much of that is associated with physical age. I don't know how much of that is that as you get older, somehow your will to live declines, or as you're suggesting, you just get bored. Yes?
That's what I didn't understand about your question.
Yes.
Was when you said, can we pick an age? Or you're saying, pick an age and live forever? Because I'm kind of on a boat where
Pick an age and live longer than you normally would live, and then the next question is going to be, how much longer would you choose?
Okay.
The next question. But the first one is, would you choose to live longer than you naturally will live, assuming you could do it without being decrepit? So if you could do it in a reasonably healthy body. Yep.
I think one thing I would think about is if you have family and kids and a wife, whether or not they would be able to live longer. I mean, as a single, young, single guy, it's a pretty easy answer, but maybe later in life you look at it differently.
You can always get another wife, produce more children.
I mean, I probably wouldn't have a problem with that either.
It's interesting. I don't know if it's true, but I've seen the following interesting assertion, that people's level of happiness does not seem in the long term to depend on the circumstances. The claim essentially is that if you have some crippling accident, such as you're on crutches for the rest of your life, you'll be miserable for a while. But that if you were a happy person before, after you've adjusted to it, you'll be about an equally happy person. And that if you're a generally gloomy, unhappy person, and you inherit $1 million, after a while it'll be a gloomy, unhappy person. I'm not sure that's right, but it's an interesting claim about human psychology. And if that's right, well, if for some reason your wife and kids decide not to do it, and they die, it'll bother you for a while. But the other thing, of course, is that in the kind of world we're thinking about in terms of the chapter's technology, there's no reason your wife and kids can't do it too. Now, what's true, of course, is that you're probably going to lose your kids. But you are anyway, because they're going to grow away from you. Right? I mean, it doesn't have to happen. You know, I'd like to imagine that 20 years from now, my son and daughter will be living close to me and be seeing them often, because they're really great people. But even when I was living an hour from my parents, I suppose I may have probably saw them once a month, but I wasn't really a part of their life, and they weren't a part of my life. And so in that sense, you sort of have to expect to lose many of the people close to you. But anyway, so one consideration is that you might just decide you got bored with life. Suppose you were getting bored with life, what might you want to do?
More adventurous, risk-taking.
Why does it have to be adventurous? I was just before the class started, I was asking how long a once-a-week two-unit class was. And the reason I was asking is that Eric Goldman has persuaded me to teach a class next fall in something like intellectual property theory, I think. And I discovered it was a two-unit class, so I was wondering whether I should do it in one day or 2 days. And the reason he persuaded me is not mainly that he's a persuasive guy and he thought the school needed it, but that I find it boring to teach the same classes for too long. All right? I'm not sure if I'm ever going to teach this course again. My sort of basic feeling initially was teach it while I write the book, teach it one more time when I've got the book. This is actually, I think, the second time since I wrote the book. And, you know, it's interesting stuff, and some new things come up as different students raise different issues, and I learn some things from student papers. But on the whole, it sort of gets decreasingly interesting the more I've been over the same ideas again. And so my real reaction to Eric was, yes, that's something that sounds interesting that I've never done. And, you know, maybe I'll write a book about it, depending on what comes out of doing it. So it seems to me that one very likely tactic, if you're right that you get bored with it, one likely tactic is you decide to do a different life in some way. You switch careers, you get divorced and marry another person, you marry when you were single, you become single when you were married. You know, you can imagine a whole lot of things, of ways in which you might be able to change life. Now, maybe you run out. Maybe, on the other hand, 100 years from now, there are going to be a bunch of options that didn't exist now. You know, 100 years from now, you can have the surgery that lets you live comfortably under the ocean. And just think what an interesting world that would be in, with a whole new civilization developing in the underwater frontier. And you can think of lots of other cases. But I think one of the things I hope you will carry away from this course is that it isn't really very likely that the world of 100 years from now is going to be much like this world. We don't know what it's going to be like. But the odds are, I think, very high that some one or another of the kinds of technologies we discussed, or maybe one we haven't thought of, will radically change things. I hope for the better, might be for the worse, might be most likely both better and worse, which is how changes usually occur. But anyway, so getting bored is one, and losing the people you care about is another. And my impression is that in the real world, the people you care about are usually replaceable. Sense that I've lost quite a lot of people over my life who I cared about, and I wish they were still alive. I regard mortality as one of the really serious deficiencies in the state of the world. One reason why this subject interests me, but nonetheless, there are other people. I no longer have my parents, but I've got two children who are now both adults and are great people. I've got a third child who's been an adult for a while. I have two grandchildren who are going to be growing up, and they maybe will provide emotional replacements for my children as my children are no longer children anymore. I get to cuddle my grandchildren. And, you know, I've lost a couple of very close friends in recent years, but I expect I'll be making other friends over as time goes on. So that one I don't find convincing, and maybe that's partly reflects the differences in our ages, because I, in a sense, have had that issue. Right? Other people who aren't sure that they would take it, even for, you know, a mere 40 or 50 years extra, put aside the question of thousands of years. Do other people want to offer reasons why they aren't sure they'd take it? Yes?
No, I thought it was, it extends the, presumably, unless you're very, very wealthy, it extends the fun part of your life, the working part of your life. Because you can't retire and live off of.
Why not?
Well, unless you're wealthy enough to support it.
What if, no, suppose you're exactly as you are now. Presumably the point at which you now plan to retire is the point at which your savings or the pension you've contracted for is enough to support you. Right? That's your present plan. Now, it's true if you're going to live much, much longer, that same amount of savings won't support you at as rich a level. On the other hand, it's not just consuming. You've got interest returns on whatever your wealth is. So all that means is you'll have to work longer or be more parsimonious about your savings or spend less. You know, but you can still retire. It just means, you know, you'll that. And for that matter, if you really wanted to in this world, you work exactly as long as you were planning to. You contract for a retirement pension which is a pension that it is agreed will go for 25 years, which we'll suppose is your life expectancy under the old dispensation. And the deal is that when the pension runs out, you say, all right, let's get another job, run another, work for another 45 years, get a pension for 25 years. So you can duplicate, from that standpoint, you would think you could duplicate the pattern you now have just over and over with the same mix of...
assuming you're still qualified for 25 years of retirement to work in the then modern...
Well, but presumably, part of the life you're now living as at this very instant is spending 3 years getting qualified. Well, you can do it again. You know, go back to law school or go to medical school or do something. No, if anything, it seems to me your situation is better because you already know how to read and write and walk and run, a whole bunch of things you had to learn for a first time. And probably, though I'm not sure, having been trained in law in 2010 or 2013 or something, will be something of an asset when you just go back and become a political scientist in 2050, because you'll have one chunk of interesting knowledge that might feed into it. So I'm not sure I find that one convincing. Other people want to tell me why they don't want to live forever? Yeah?
How about just like the state of the world? Like, maybe you think the world's going to get a lot worse or something, or if like something changes that totally disrupts you, like you're going to retire, and you retire, and you have all these savings, and it's like hyper.
Yeah, but of course that could happen now.
Yeah.
So in terms of the world getting worse, I could certainly see you're saying that along with taking the life extension treatment, I'd also like to have a small stash of cyanide pills just in case, so that if it turns out that the world is so bad you don't want to live in it, you have an exit. But presumably, it seems to me, unless you're sure the world is going to be bad, you might as well stay around and see. And if it turns out well, you live. And if it turns out bad enough, you die. And that's better than having to die, which is the present option. Other people want to offer contributions to this? Yes?
I don't want to do forever. Saying even most people talk about the loved one dying. But if I fall down one day, I don't have to live through every single of my loved one die. But if I have to live the longest, I have to see every single of my loved one die the same.
But to begin with, there's no reason to assume they can't do the same thing.
Okay, if they can do the same thing, what accidental death?
You might die accidentally. They might die accidentally. There's no more reason to think, assuming that all of you get life extension, there's no more reason to think they'll die before you than there is now. Could go either way. It's not political. That's an interesting question. I have one friend, a colleague when I was at UCLA, economist, who told me at one point that she was not confident that the present value of utility at birth was positive. Present value of utility at birth, for the non-economist, you're adding up all of the happiness and unhappiness of your lifetime and somehow trying to sum it. Now, on the one hand, this was an intelligent, productive, very able person. She was later on the Council of Economic Advisors, as it happens. And she's now, I think, happily married to another well-known economist. On the other hand, I happen to know that she got pregnant, I think, at 14, if I remember correctly, by her high school teacher. I think that's right. Married him. Got divorced a few years later. I think she had a baby. Maybe it was 15. I think she had a baby when she was 15 or 16. I met the daughter, very nice girl. And she seemed sort of happy about the fact that she had a daughter, but pretty clearly the early part of her life had been fairly hard. So one possible answer is, you know, maybe life isn't worth living, or on net, or in the future it isn't worth living. And the mild evidence against that is that so few people kill themselves. And that suggests that most people at least feel as though. But maybe it's just that we've got sort of very strong psychological barriers against killing ourselves. It's really hard to do, and therefore, so. But that's one possible answer, and that, in a sense, goes back to what I was saying before about this claim that one of the innate differences in people is how happy they are. Because after all, if that's right, then what's really happening is I'm a happy person. I feel as though I've had a good life. I've been lucky. My parents' autobiography is entitled "Two Lucky People," which I thought was rather neat. But I feel the same way. Maybe that's just I happen to have some combination of, you know, hormones or something that makes me an optimist who sees the world as, you know, a pleasant place. And just as reasonable that I want to live forever that way as that someone else to whom the world is sort of gloomy and tinged and so forth. I remember my mother's brother apparently told my mother at some point that she was always saving for a rainy day and living in a perpetual drizzle. which I thought was a pretty good line. So maybe, I think she was a pretty happy person on the whole, though maybe less so than I was, or I am. But you can certainly imagine people who are always expecting things to go wrong. And, you know, if you fall in love, what does that mean? It means one more person who could die and make you miserable, or who could reject you and make you miserable, and so forth. So that would be another reason why you might not. You just aren't that happy about life in general. Other answers, other suggestions? All right, let's keep going this. And so I'm curious, my next question is, what age? All right, let's suppose, again, that you can either choose to keep getting older and then stop at some point, or you can wind it back. And I'm assuming winding back doesn't mean you lose your memories or anything of that sort. It's just the physical condition of your body. I'm curious, how many people would choose a physical age of 20 or younger? Nobody. How about between 20 and 30? That seems to be the preferred age. All right. Practically everybody. I'll stop there then. Yeah, I'm not sure what I would do. I was sort of thinking about that question, and the question of what are the disadvantages, that a certain sense is, you know, maybe at 18 or 19, in some ways you're sort of at your peak. Maybe not. How about, let's divide a little finer, 20 to 25 as opposed to 26 to 30. How many prefer 20 to 25? Huh. That's interesting. All right. 26 to 30? I'm curious, what are your reasons? Yeah?
At 24, it became much harder to drink in excess. Run far and fast.
And that was good or bad?
Oh, bad. Just 24, I feel like, with my...
There's a song by some... I'm trying to remember, by someone, not very well-known singer, but he happens to be somebody who I know slightly, about, I can't party the way I partied when I was 24. I think it's something like that. It's sort of fun, you know. Well, I don't remember the words anymore, but it's fairly cleverly done, but on that subject, essentially.
Yeah, I lost weight easier. I ate whatever I want more often, drank whatever I want. So.
How about people on the other side, people who wanted to start at more than 25? Anybody want to give it? Yeah?
I would say that just in general, you're taken more seriously when you're not in your early.
That's going to be tricky, though, because in this world, after a while, people will know that your physical age isn't your real age.
I don't know.
That is, one of the questions I raised, I think, in the book, which intrigued me, was the dating implications of this. That if you, and of course from a dating purpose, you probably want to be fairly young, because certainly for women, maybe for men as well, that on average men are more attracted to women at 25 than at 30, and more probably at 20 than at 25. Well, that's going to vary with the man and with the people. But one of the interesting questions would be, how would you react to somebody who had a 20-year-old body who you happen to know was 90 years old? Would you still, in a dating kind of context, would you still be attracted to the person more or less or differently than if it was a 25-year-old person and a 25-year-old body? And that's sort of one of the, I don't know the answer, it just struck me as an intriguing question as to, you know, how much... I mean, in general, it's sort of a question of how much in sort of romantic-related things are we really interacting with the person and how much with the person's body? Because both of them pretty clearly are affecting our interactions. And I sort of engage in introspection when I look at random women and say, you know, this woman strikes me as attractive. That one doesn't. It's not aesthetics. It's somehow some template in my head of what I want, of, you know, what strikes me. And it's different for different people, obviously. And that's separate from the other template, which is this person I really like. And that sort of is the insides of the person, and that one presumably isn't going to depend on what your physical body looks like. Except, of course, that some of your personality may be affected by it. Because one of the things, the point none of you have raised, but one of the things that occurred to me, one of the reasons I might even want more than 30, I'm not sure, is that at 20, say, you're much more a slave to your hormones. You're much more likely to really lust after members of the opposite sex, to fall passionately and irrationally in love. There are a bunch of sort of intense emotional things, many of which I think tend to fade a bit somewhere between 20 and 30, and maybe more from 30 and 40. And I'm not sure if I'm for or against those things. That, you know, I've sort of daydreamed, you know, what would it be like? Actually, I've got a short story somewhere where somebody is given the option, and the way I tell the story, you never know if it's the devil or an alien or who's giving the option, but he's given the option to redo his college years. But it's optional. That is basically, he can go back and start again when he was in college. Parallel life, as it were. And at any point in the next 4 years, he can push a button and he's back. And by assumption, he's had a reasonably satisfactory life. He's, I don't know what I had, he's 45 or 50. He's married. He's got a couple of kids he likes. He's got a job he's happy with. But on the other hand, he sort of regrets the fact that he knows other people when they were in college had a really lively time. They had affairs. They did this. They partied. And he was sort of serious and intellectual and socially retarded, thinking of myself, of course, as the model I'm actually building on, and therefore didn't do a lot of what people did. And so he's given this option and told you can go back, and he goes back. And this time with all the experience board, indeed, he, you know, has a very lively social life, does pretty well in class, because, of course, he knows the stuff, even though he's forgotten some of it, gets to relearn it. He's really enjoying himself. He's no question, it's just, isn't this great? And then he falls in love. And he gets involved with a woman with whom it's not just play, whom it's really serious, and they start discussing their future. And he then realizes that he's almost at the deadline when he's got to decide whether to vanish back into his previous life or to abandon his previous life, as it were. Which, I mean, presumably he's not going to lose his kids, their parent. One assumes, I never go into detail, that his other self, as it were, is going to keep on living in that alternate reality. But he gets to choose whether his consciousness goes back or not. And I just leave it there. But it struck me as sort of an intriguing. But part of what intrigued me was the idea of how different being a 19-year-old again would feel, with sort of the world being brighter and the emotions more intense, and in some ways it's good, and in some ways it's not so good. So I'm not sure what age I would take. There's a Heinlein novel, incidentally, in which one of the secondary characters, who clearly has access to the equivalent of this technology, explains that what he did was to give himself, I think it was something like the body of maybe a 24-year-old, but the appearance of about a 50-year-old, because that way people take him seriously. They don't sort of think of him as physically threatening, but if necessary, you know, he's still got the muscles and the reaction speed and so forth. And that was sort of a fancier version than I'm putting, but it was an interesting kind of concept. Yeah, I think it does matter, going back to the point that was raised earlier, how other people are going to treat you. So if you assume, take an assumption different than one I'm using. Suppose you're the only one who gets to do it, no one else is going to know. All right, so suppose you have the option of changing to a different age, you can do it again and again if necessary, but other people will assume that if you look 19, you're 19, if you look 50, you're 50. Now the argument for the younger ages becomes weaker, precisely for the reason that somebody already raised, that people are likely to take you more seriously. Some people, depends on the context, not if you're dating, but if what you're doing is getting a job or giving a speech or running for Congress, people take you more seriously at 40 than they do at 20. And so there's a sort of a status difference that you might want. But going back to my world, my guess, though I'm not sure, is that once everybody's adjusted, they will recognize that it's not the physical appearance, it's the actual age that becomes relevant. So, all right, so almost everybody here, it's 20 to 30 is what they see as their ideal age, which presumably is what almost all of you are, right? There's one of the students in my other seminar, he's younger than I am, but not a lot younger than I am. He's somebody who went back to law school, and I'm curious if he was in this room what answer he would give, whether, because in my case, I think I want to push it back to at least 45, because I think it would be a little after 45 that I started seeing inconvenient symptoms due to age. And beyond that, I was certainly a better athlete at 30 than I was at 45, but, you know, insofar as they ever did athletics activity, which was a very odd sort, namely sword and shield fighting and medieval historical recreation, which I was actually good at, to my surprise, because I'd always been terrible at gym classes. I worked out later that part of the reason I was terrible at gym classes was that everybody else there did basketball and baseball and stuff for fun and already knew how to do it, and I only did it in gym. But in any case, I could see some advantages for the younger body, but they aren't very large advantages. And, you know, I don't really mind not being able to do that sort of thing. But I'm not sure if I'd want... I'm pretty sure I wouldn't want to push back to 18, except maybe briefly as sort of a vacation adventure. I don't think I want to actually live at that age again, if I can help it. But I'm not sure I'd want to go as young as 30, actually. Don't know. Interesting question. All right, so let me go on with this. It seemed to me this is sort of a fun way of doing this chapter, was to sort of try to have all of us try to think about the lives we would live under various alternative futures. So let's take the next one, which is, suppose you decide to live much longer. And suppose you can adjust your age so you're not living much longer as a, you know, fragile 90-year-old. What kind of a life would you live? All right, what would you do with the extra 100 years? People have opinions. Trying to imagine the life. And you can see a bunch of different possible options. Anything? Nobody?
I would travel. Like doing now and
you do the things you so you'd live the same kind of life you're living now, just much longer.
Yeah, although I would presume that I would work and then, like you said, build up some sort of retirement, invest it in some sort of income producing. I feel like I'm one of those people, like I would be content to not need a huge income.
And you also think that you're somebody who's got enough willpower so that for the first 40 years you could live at a reasonably moderate level, work pretty hard, and deliberately make a point of accumulating money.
Yeah, my only concern is going back is, what's the world going to be like, is everything that I want to see not going to be there?
Yes.
When I want to go see it.
So you're going to want to do some traveling in advance, yeah, and just do it at as low expense as you can manage.
Yeah, but there's moments when, you're traveling, you're backpacking by yourself, and I'm, extremely thankful I'm doing it in a 20-year-old body.
That's right. Yes.
That's one reason why I do it now, is because I can't imagine
Absolutely.
Doing it.
My current suitcase that I mostly use is one of the models which converts into a backpack. I'm not sure I've ever converted it.
Yeah.
Its predecessor. I should say, if you want to get good, moderately expensive luggage, let me recommend Eagle Creek. Because its predecessor, I think I had bought it before I was married, and I bought another one for my wife as a wedding present. And 20 years later, it was beginning to wear out. And that one I used the backpack on. Now, of course, that one also didn't have wheels. That was before wheels became that common. And I do use the wheels on mine. And I can still carry a backpack if I have to, but it would seem like a less natural and comfortable thing to do than it did 20 years ago or 30 years ago, when that was what I normally did with that suitcase. So, but your basic answer is that you would live more or less the life you're living, except that you think you would save more and be able to at least semi-retire.
I just don't have the means to do that perpetually, forever. Or for at least a great length of time.
Well, you have the means if you're willing to first spend 50 or 60 or 70 years working and saving.
And didn't halt my aging process.
Yes.
My life, yeah. I'm going to age.
Sure. But assuming you halt your age for aging process at something around now, that you then think that you would probably do a little less touristing than you now do, but some, and you would probably consume a little less than you now do, and you would try to build up the resources so that you would end up as a retired person just seeing the world.
Or find a way, to work 6 months, travel 6 months. That can be done in present day, but it's very difficult to achieve that.
Not all that difficult. I teach one semester on and one semester off.
Okay. But you don't have, perpetual 20-year-old body to do it in.
Yes.
So that way I think I'm providing myself, I guess, the best of both worlds, because I get those 6 months to stay.
But if you did,
that
prior to the first 50 years, you'd never build up the stake that you need in order to retire, right?
Yeah. So perhaps I think I need a nest egg.
And once you've got a sufficient nest egg, you think you would then go to working part time, traveling part time.
Yeah.
Would you ever fully retire if you could? Only travel?
I don't think so. Even if I did, I'm one of those people that's bored if I'm not learning something. So,
right.
I'd be enrolled in a 2-credit course or learning to speak some sort of language if I wasn't
working. Yes, that's an interesting point. To what degree to what degree some of the things one does, including some of the ones that we think of as done for money, are really things you would do anyway. Yep, no. Somebody back there had a point? Yes, no. I thought you were raising your hand when she was talking. No. Other people want to make comments on what they think they would do?
Well, I was just going to comment on that idea. I guess maybe if you had all that time, you could even see the idea of traveling becoming different. You just travel to a country and got all the time in the world, why not take up a job there and live with those people? And then when you want to move on to a different country, you go there. You know, the idea of travel might just change.
Are you thinking of units of years or decades? The reason I ask is that
how long you live.
I understand, but that is one of the intriguing possibilities if you don't age is essentially living a series of very different lives. So one model I could imagine is you find another country you think is a really interesting and attractive country. You move there, you learn the language, you get a job, maybe even you marry there. 50 years later, you move on. So you've, as it were, lived another life as an inhabitant of Singapore or Italy or China or whatever country intrigues you. That would be one thing you could imagine doing. The other people want to tell me what they would do? No?
Something to keep me occupied. The medieval cathedrals, it would take hundreds of years to build. And of course, the life expectancy was a lot shorter than, just some big project that you could actually get the satisfaction of seeing through to completion.
Maybe. On the other hand, it's going to be pretty hard for the first 50 years when you're not getting any satisfaction. You're just working on it and working on it. I have some pretty long-scale projects. I've got projects in various parts of my life that have been running for well over 20 years, maybe one of them maybe 30 years, and I'm not sure if it's succeeding or not succeeding. It's sort of hard to tell. But
you're still working on it.
Yeah, I'm still working on that one. Yes?
Two things that kind of struck me when we took the poll that everybody who would choose to be to stay 20 to 30, I can't help but imagine that a majority of the population might feel that way just because of the physical benefits that come with the age. And so it's really hard to imagine the hypothetical world. Everybody that looked like, didn't they just come out with some movie where like everybody looks super young?
Don't know about the movie, but that would be.
So it's just, first of all, that's really hard to imagine. Second of all, I mean, my personal comment, but if somebody told me that, the prospect of marriage would seem very remote. Just the concept, because it's like some of the things that benefits I associate marriage with the fact that you get to grow old with somebody.
So that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about it. Let me take a poll. How many people here think that if they weren't getting older, it is less, you could certainly see that you might spend longer looking for a mate because you've got the time, but that it is less likely that at some point in the next 40 years they would get married than it is now? All right, I want to limit people who aren't married yet. You think that it's less likely that if you were going to live a long time that you would get married in the next 40 years. Do other people agree or not?
And I'm assuming my ability to create children also extends
almost indefinitely. That's right. So it's clear that especially for women, you're under less time pressure in that world than you are now, because at the moment you know that subject to possibility of various biological improvements, but as things now stand, if you don't produce kids by about 40 or so, the various risks associated start getting much higher. That's in a sense a reason why you might say, well, let's wait another 5 years, though people do that often anyway. But then the other question, and of course there are technologies now developing much short of this which solve that problem, namely ways of preserving the eggs and then implanting them at a older age. So it may be that by the time you're old enough for it to be a serious problem, they will solve that problem, but maybe they won't. But so that's a reason to slow it down. But the question is, does it just mean you get married in 10 years instead of in 5, or does it mean you say, well, hey, you'll never get married at all? Or, one of the ones that intrigues me, would you end up with marriages but without the assumption that it was permanent? All right, a lot of marriages aren't permanent. But nonetheless, the standard rule, I think for all of us still, is that when you get married, your intent is that you'll be married the rest of your life, even though you realize that it might not happen. And I can certainly see an argument for saying, well, look, when you were only going to live up to 90, the rest of your life was just about how long you wanted to live with that person, 500 years. And especially if you're thinking, if your model for living long, it's indeed one of the attractive models, is the one in which you live, as it were, a sequence of different lives. Change your country, you can change your profession. Or you could say, well, look, it's one of the things that I'm going to discuss in the chapter. One of the things you can imagine doing is you do an ordinary profession, you do it for the normal length of time, you retire for a while, you get bored, and you say, well, it was really interesting being a Marine officer, I think I'm going to be a novelist. That's a real example, by the way. There happens to be a reasonably good science fiction and fantasy novelist, a woman who was a retired Marine officer, Elizabeth Moon. But if you did that, it might also make sense to say, but wait a minute, the same argument, say, well, it was really nice being married to you. I mean, you know, we had a happy 50 years, but, you know, you're getting a little bored with me, I'm getting a little bored with you. Maybe we should go out on the market again. You go back to the business of dating and searching and all of that excitement and so forth and so on, and end up with somebody else, and we'll always be friends. I mean, we've got kids in common. They're still alive, too, of course. So that would be an interesting possibility. And you could also imagine intermediate versions. You could say, wait a minute. I'm not sure I can do better than you. But you and I would both like a vacation. So how about we have a temporary divorce, just for 10 years. And then if, you know, assuming we don't find somebody we really like better, we're back together again. That's fine. But that's reminding me of something. Somewhere online, somebody was discussing the question of the tax implications of marriage. And that under some circumstances, being married means you pay more taxes than if you weren't married. And the story, supposedly the story was of a couple who got divorced on the last day of the year and remarried on the first day of the next year, thus being single at the end of the year, which was relevant for filing their taxes. And the IRS objected that this was just a fraudulent divorce. And their explanation was they wanted to be free to play around with somebody else on New Year's Eve without violating their marriage vows. Whether anybody believed that, I don't know, but I thought it was a wonderful explanation of what was going on. How about getting married at all? How many people think there's a sizable chance that if they were going to live for much, much, much longer, they would not get married? Of people who think they're going to get married. That's when we started. Yeah.
Suppose you wanted to hold marriage fast, because when younger, having less knowledge, less experience, you are less separate. So when you get married, it's more likely that you guys will get along. But if you get older, you got more accustomed to your will of life, more difficult to accompany.
That's a possible conjecture, but I could make the argument the other way and say, look, when you're young, you're being driven by your hormones. You really want a sex partner, and besides, this person has suddenly become the most important person in the world to you for reasons that are sort of programming inside your head, and therefore you jump into marriage, you know, marry in haste, repent at leisure, as somebody once put it, and you're quite likely to get the wrong person. Whereas after the first 80 years or so, you know, you have a much clearer understanding of what you need and what people get along with, and you can do a sort of a cool, calm evaluation of the alternatives and say, yeah, she's really an exciting lady, but it's not going to work. Whereas that one, yeah, you know, we've been good friends for 15 years now. I know I like her. We're very compatible. Let's try 80 years as a married couple. Yeah.
That's probably true, but probably less likely people who got married than
Yeah. Don't know about the after, but yeah. But anyway, so what are people's opinions? Yeah.
I think when you get married, you're not thinking about how long you're gonna live. Boy meets girl, fall in love, they get 1,000 years each other. They're not thinking about, all right, 50 years, should I get married?
But then,
it happened that bad. I'm thinking.
Right, so therefore you marry in haste and repent at leisure, but do you repent? That is the question I'm raising. You're perfectly right that it is, that one way of thinking about it is assume we're sort of rationally looking at how we'll live our lives, another is that's not the way we're going to behave. But then, once you've gotten married, and once the glow has worn off, that there is a real qualitative difference between being in love and loving someone. That I still love my wife after 20-some years, but I'm not really in love with her. Indeed, I would say I was more in love in a relevant sense with our children when they were little children than with my wife. Because if you do, for those of you who have been parents, I don't know how many of you have, maybe most, maybe none of you have, but by introspection, the emotional reaction to your own children is a lot like the emotional reaction to somebody you're in love with. That this child, for no good reason, is the most important person in the world. It's a kind of intensity, which is the same intensity, it seems to me, that you have with romantic love. So, after you've gone through the initial sections, now it might be that you would say, all right, if this one breaks down, not going to be another. Or not going to be another for a long time. Or you might say, next time we're going to have a term limit. We're going to contract for 40 years. As you may know, in Shia Islamic law, there are temporary marriages. And some of the temporary marriages are essentially a way of making fornication or prostitution fit into the system. But some of them are temporary marriages for long periods of time. And I gather from some of the stuff I was reading on it that that's partly because the legal rules for ordinary marriage are quite restrictive on the terms, whereas for temporary marriages you've got much closer to freedom of contract. In how you agree to what you do, but in any case, so people think they would. Or how many people think it is reasonably likely that if you did find what appeared to be the right person, you would stay married essentially for the rest of your life? For the rest of your life being hundreds of years, anybody think they would? There's an optimist. You may be right. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, also a few hundred years from now, you know, we talked, I think, in the first week about mind drugs. Possibility of chemically induced love. So
that's right.
What it's going to be like.
So you may have the option. You may have the option of saying, we're going to stay married forever. And, you know, every 10 years we'll fall in love again. Just take the right pill. And if we ever find that we're no longer loving each other, well, maybe there's another pill for that. So you could imagine that's a possibility. But of course you don't have to. The question is, why would you choose to? Why wouldn't you say, well, yes, indeed, I could take the pill and be in love with you. But, you know, she's much sexier. And I'm sort of getting bored with your personality, and you're a little bit of a shrew, and so maybe I should separate with you and take the pill with her. Right? Or maybe you don't even need the pill with her. Right? What?
He's not talking about Viagra, is he?
No, he's talking about Viagra affects your ability to have sex. It doesn't, as far as I know, affect what degree you fall in love. So, other people's thoughts? Yeah.
It seems kind of like the whole, being young and single, looking around, dating, getting married, would just be extended for a very long period of time. So
the question is, would that happen or would you get bored with it? Because I'm not sure, but if I try to look back, going back to my point about that short story that I wrote, I'm not really sure I would want that. That it's sort of, it's fun to imagine being a college student and, you know, dating and having sex and breaking up and all that. It's not really very exciting. It makes a good story and such. But I'm not really sure I would prefer that to the much calmer life I'm now living.
Yeah. So that's how I see it, is that instead it would be like the period of your 20s, but say for like 200 years.
But would it be, or would you get bored with that?
I personally think I would. I would say, okay, I've done everything I wanted to do as a solitary person.
And I bet it wouldn't take you 200 years either.
Okay. Maybe 100, however long. And then, or the world around me, just, you know, whatever my primary goal was for choosing to live as long as it suddenly dissipates, and I finally just decide, okay, there's nothing to see, we're polluting the world, and if I have to get stuck living for a remainder 300 years, I'm going to pick a companion and settle down and hide.
Yeah. I get the impression from the sort of stuff I read that an awful lot of the people now in roughly your age group or a little below aren't too happy with the sort of with a culture where it is assumed that something close to sexual promiscuity is normal, and there are hookups and various other terminology and such, which doesn't describe how everybody behaves, but it's sort of, in some sense, some of the much more nearly current social rules than they were when I was the same age. And the other reason, an awful lot of people really have said, well, you know, that really looked really nice sort of from a distance, but it's sort of wearing and boring, and I don't want to be in a different bed every night, so to speak. And if so, I just say my guess is that your 200 years is way too long and that people will enjoy that life for a while, but they're going to want other things. And one possible other thing is marriage or the equivalent, some kind of a long-term connection. What about careers? Let's take a different version of the same question. How many, and let me take three, what seems to me the sort of the three big alternatives. One of them is you run a career through the way you're now planning to do, but you run it long enough so you accumulate enough to retire on. And maybe you do some work when you're retired if you think if there are fun things you get an opportunity to do, but basically you don't have to work anymore. That's option A. Option B is you work at the same career more or less forever, assuming that the job doesn't disappear. It might disappear with technological change, but assuming it doesn't. You got trained as a lawyer, assuming that after being a lawyer for 5 or 10 years, you say, yeah, I like being a lawyer. It's sort of a pretty satisfactory career. You say, fine, I'm going to be a lawyer forever. Maybe I'll take 5-year vacations from time to time, but that's it. And then the third option is run through one career, maybe retire for a while, pick an entirely different career that interests you and do that next. How many people? So three options. Why don't I write it down? One is work, retire. Retire goes forever, more or less. One is work forever with perhaps intervals of retirement in between, and after you've retired for 4 or 5 years and run around the world, you say, well, guys, I start getting bored. Why don't I get back to doing what I'm good at doing and like doing? What?
Can you call
me
the nightmare option?
I don't know. My guess is that there are people for whom it isn't. And then C is work A, retire for a while, work B, retire for a while, C, and so forth. So how many people among those three alternatives, how many people think they would choose number one? What you were describing before, wasn't it?
Yeah, you would think so.
All right. How many people would think they choose number two? Is everybody think that's a nightmare, or does somebody think that actually was? What are you doing in law school? You don't think you want to be a lawyer forever, right? So everybody thinks they choose number three? Okay. Yeah, so do I think, on the whole. And in a sense, I have. I mean, my doctorate's in theoretical physics, so in that sense, I have changed several times. And then I was doing economics, and then I was doing law and economics, and I used to be at economics departments, and now I'm in law school, and I wrote my first novel 5 or 6 years ago, and I could certainly imagine, if I got sufficiently bored here, retiring from this and just spending my time writing novels and arguing with people online, which I do lots of anyway. And I could even imagine, under circumstances, switching to being a computer programmer, because I've done a little bit of programming, and it's clearly a sort of a fun and an emotionally satisfying thing. It's one of the human desires is to make machines that run, I think. And physical machines are a real pain to make, because you've got to get all the pieces right. But a computer program is a machine that runs, and it still is harder than you think it's going to be, just because things are always more complicated than you think. But it's a lot easier than physical machines, and it would be sort of neat to say, well, I've got this idea, let's instantiate it in code. I've done a little bit of that. It would be fun to do more. So that would be another life I could imagine living. A lot of lives I wouldn't want to live, of course, but that's presumably true of everybody. All right, so that's interesting that particular version is. All right, next one. Yeah?
If you want to choose a different career, that means you have to take a financial cut every time you change a career.
That's right.
And then how are you going to get used to a certain kind of income level?
But you, but if that's a serious issue, though, you can bridge it by your savings. That is, you can say, I'll do the first career until I've accumulated enough money to support me at a standard I'm happy with while I switch to the second career. And you can certainly imagine doing it in that way. So I don't think you have to take a cut, though you could certainly choose to take the cut.
And not even savings. You figure you'd already own your house in your first career.
That is savings, really.
Your education paid off.
You
wouldn't have kids, presumably, that you could.
You might have kids, but your kids will have grown up by now, and they'll be supporting themselves.
Young children to support.
Yeah.
So it would be, you could live on less money.
Let me try one more, which is sort of interesting. First, how many of you expect to have children? That's nice. Good. Glad there are going to be people around in the world in the future. How many of you think that if you were going to live hundreds of years, you would keep having children? That is to say, you have children, you bring them up, maybe you wait a while because you want the vacation. Would you then at some point, you know, maybe after the first 100 years, say, well, this was really neat. I like little kids. It's sort of an exciting thing to do. Let's have another set. How many people think they would? One? What?
It's hard to answer.
It's true.
Would you?
It's true. I don't know. It's a very interesting question because I really liked bringing up kids. I mean, they were real sweethearts. It's happened by good luck to have the world's most wonderful children.
So what is the next pass you make? Aren't you good?
Well, that's one problem. You're right. You're absolutely right. The one issue in having kids, I mean, having kids in one way is very scary. You don't get to send them back. All right? One of the reasons I only have two children in my present marriage, I have one child in my first marriage, instead of three, is that my wife was afraid she wouldn't like having children. And the result was, first it took me quite a while to talk her into getting married, because she also wasn't sure she wanted to be married to anybody. She'd never expected to be. I think she was a graduate student when we met, and I was the first man she'd ever dated. But then, after we got married, she wasn't sure that she would enjoy being a mother. She's a very responsible person, and if she had children, she'd obviously have a very long-term commitment to them. And so it was quite a while before she decided she was willing to risk it. And then it turned out that she really liked being a mother. We had wonderful children. It was really great. And we would have liked to have one more child, but she was too old at that point to do it. So in that sense, but you're right. I mean, it is the scary thing. And it's scary both for the extreme cases of things like Down syndrome, but it's also scary for the much less extreme case of having a kid who doesn't like you and who you don't like. Right? I mean, that would be really, really, a really ugly, ugly life to have that situation occur. Now, maybe it won't. I do not know. I mean, obviously saying I have the best children in the world is a joke. But I really do have very nice children. I think many other people would agree with that. I don't know how much of that is because we did the right way of bringing them up, because we are nice people, and how much of that is the pure luck of the draw. And it's scary to think that if you did it again, it might not work. So that would be one argument against. That's certainly right. Beyond that, though, I can certainly imagine that at a point when I've known other things for a long time, so to speak, that if we were back in young bodies, that we might decide to do it again. Because it would be sort of neat. I mean, we would like to have had one more child. See how it turned out. Because we have two children who are very different. Each of them shows many of my and my wife's characteristics, but different mixes of those characteristics in each person. And as I say, they're two of my favorite people. So that would be sort of neat. So my guess is that I would eventually try it again, but I'm not absolutely certain.
Kind of like gambling, you just keep doing it until you get a bad batch, and then you say, okay,
I'm done. Maybe, or maybe you want to do it again, so you'll make up for the bad one, as it were. All right, let me go on to the next technology, and that's cryonic suspension. All right, and now the question is, suppose somebody comes to you and says, look, for a moderate fee, which we'll suppose you can easily afford, we will sign you up. It's essentially an insurance policy. And we will arrange, and you'll have a wrist thing, or the kind of thing people wear for health information, such that if you ever go into hospital with something lethal, they will read it, they will call up Alcor, Alcor will check the situation, and 10 minutes before you would have died, Alcor will come in, and assuming it's legal, they will start cooling your body. You've prepaid for having your body, or maybe your head, depending which way we do it, kept at liquid nitrogen temperatures until when and if it becomes possible to revive. And I'm now, unlike the previous case, I'm not sure, I'm not assuming you know what happens. In the previous case, I was assuming that the technology happened. I am assuming the current situation, which is that it is a gamble. And different people have different opinions on whether the change will ever be revived is, you know, 2 out of 3 if you're really optimistic, or 1 in a million if you're really pessimistic. So whatever your odds are. And the question is, putting aside the question of whether the cost is more than you can afford, how many people are fairly sure that they would sign up for that deal? How many are fairly sure that you... Yeah. How many are fairly sure that they wouldn't? Huh, all right, I'm curious about those ones. Because I'm in the middle. I should say, one of my friends involved with this from time to time has urged me to sign up. I could afford it quite easily. Maybe I should, and yet I never have. So I really don't know. So for the people who are pretty sure they wouldn't, why wouldn't they? Yep?
I've just been one too many science fiction words. You wake up, and the world just sucks. And even if it doesn't suck, it's not the world you knew. Go back to the same place you ate great shawarma. It's not there. It's replaced by some fast food joint.
Yes.
You want to, you know, if the, I'm kind of assuming here that 50-50 on the people that you love and cherish are choosing to do that. So you wake, come back, some of your friends are there. Some of
your
friends aren't.
In this story, they probably haven't, because I'm giving you a version soon enough, so you only do it if you're dying of something.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people are going to die without having that opportunity.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know whether I read this somewhere in the reading, but it's like you're in the state of your advanced disease, so maybe you decided to do it upon diagnosis of the disease,
right.
So you're not in your decrepit state.
Yes.
But I probably wouldn't want to do it right before I die in my decrepit state.
Depending on how much you think they can repair. That is part of the theory, really, is that by the time they can bring you back, most other medical problems will be trivial in comparison. It may not be right, but that's what people are saying.
But I don't, you know, unlike the previous scenario where I'm at a young age and I'm kind of being and I'm adapting and I'm learning to the world as it changes, I wake up and suddenly everybody's typing in private, public key communication.
Yes.
I have no idea how that works. There's little cameras watching me everywhere.
Yes.
I don't like that. You know.
Yeah. No, I think you're making a very real point that the idea, my guess is I would come down the other side of you, but I'm not sure, because it's true that the idea, it's sort of saying, look, I've spent the first X years of my life learning the world, learning to function in it, and suddenly I'm going to be dropped in an entirely different world, and everything I know gets wiped out, and I've got to start again like a 2-year-old almost, making sense of the world. That's a really scary feeling, and especially because maybe if you were 19, all right, that's all right, but if you're 60, you aren't feeling quite so flexible and so willing to start over again. So, and you know, I mean, I guess I see it in a way in the fact that my current desktop Macintosh is not running the latest operating system. All right. My laptop is, because it has to be. The Air only comes with Lion. But I haven't switched from the one next to latest, because I have to learn a bunch of new stuff, and I already know how to operate with Snow Leopard, I think is the previous version. I understand, but my point is that that's an example. And my guess is that 30 years ago I would have switched. That some of it really is that as you get older, you're less excited at the idea of, isn't it fun to learn something new, which certainly has been my attitude for a long time, and I still have some of that attitude. But there's more of a shift to, isn't it a real pain to have to learn something new because what you thought you knew doesn't work anymore. Yeah.
I think the time in between scares me a little bit. If you somehow remain conscious, I'm not
sure
that an indefinite amount of time
is... Yes.
The walls of my own mind are...
Yes. People, there have been science fiction stories that play off that, of course.
Yeah, there's a good scene before that.
But other people... Yes.
Well, I mean, think about living 100 years and then also hundreds of years and also this breathing and kind of come back. But I guess for people who really believe in hereafter, we have to say...
They don't need to. That's right.
This life isn't the best thing, maybe.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's true. And in that sense, my presentation in the chapter is really very one-sided. Because I decided at about age 10, I think, that the odds were that God didn't exist. And I had an argument, which I since decided was not as compelling an argument as I thought, but I still have the same opinion. I know as an objective fact that there are a bunch of people out there, including people I think very highly of, who really think God exists and an afterlife exists, and it's real for them. And, but I wasn't, in writing that chapter, I really wasn't looking through their eyes, I was looking through my eyes. I was assuming that dying means you're buried and you rot and you're gone. Going back to your point, by the way, when you're talking about how the place you went to wouldn't be there, I actually have a poem on my webpage, which I wrote after both my mother and a very old friend died, and the title is Places I Cannot Go. And the point of that is, yes, the physical place is still there, but what really defined it was the person living there, and that person doesn't exist anymore. And that is a really weird idea to me. I mean, I know it has to be true, but the fact that somebody I knew well no longer is in the world seems very strange. Depressing, too, but also just hard to intuit, as it were. I wondered if part of the reason that people believe in life after death is that the amount of data that comes into your eyes is not enough to reconstruct the world you're seeing. That I think it's more or less demonstrable that you have to have a bunch of hardwired facts about the world is like produced by evolution, which combined with the data coming into your eyes, let me tell that this is a separate object from that, which is part of the information about it. If I just look at it as a pattern of blue and white and tan, it doesn't tell me that. One of the facts of reality that's hardwired into us is continuity. The fact that if this thing was here a second ago, it's almost certainly very close to here now. Right. Not perfectly true. Bubbles feel weird and magical because they just disappear. Well, maybe the reason people believe in life after death is that other human personalities are one of the most vivid and real things we know about, and if you've got hardwired into your brain the belief in continuity, it's hard to see how they could wink out. All right, I don't know. That's a guess, and it may well be a mistaken guess, but it did strike me as an interesting point. Let me mention very briefly something else before we go on, and that is that in addition to that one of the current projects is, which I have a footnote about, is called Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence, and that's a project by a sort of smart, slightly crazy guy, interesting fellow. And his theory really is that it's going to be very hard to literally stop aging, but that aging is the sum of a whole bunch of changes happening in us, and if we learn enough, we can patch each one of them, as it were, so that even though in principle we're getting older, we're getting physically older very, very slowly. And he's associated with a project called the Mouse Prize, which is sort of like the prize they had for a private spaceship, if you're familiar with that one. And the Mouse Prize, if I remember correctly, is for the first person who can come up with a way of reliably doubling the lifespan of a mouse. And it's sort of a neat idea of rewarding a breakthrough in longevity research well short of the eventual breakthroughs you eventually want. I also wanted to say a little bit about this issue of what happens when we no longer have signals of age. There's the question of, do you treat people who look like 20 as 20-year-olds, or do you first ask when they were born? And it occurred to me that we're seeing some of those effects already online. That, for example, in World of Warcraft, you don't know how old the person you're interacting with, and you don't know what gender the person is. That my wife was telling, I guess, two different stories relevant to that. And one of them was that in World of Warcraft, she was engaged actually in a business transaction with somebody. She was making something. You can craft stuff in World of Warcraft, and he was buying it. And sort of they were chatting. And at some point at the end of it, he says, "Are you really a girl?" Her avatar, the character she's playing, is female. And she said, "Well, I'm a woman." Sort of, given that she's in her 50s, calling herself a girl seemed a little bit odd. And he said, "That's surprising, I can usually tell." And pretty clearly what he was saying was that he had interpreted her style of interaction as being that of a male, even though the avatar she was playing is female. And her other story is being in a group in World of Warcraft, a raid, where some of the people were on Ventrilo, which is a program that lets you speak to each other so you can hear your voices. And they were chatting while the raid was going on. And one of the men in the raid said that he had never met a woman who had a male character in World of Warcraft. He knew men who had female characters in World of Warcraft. And there's a long silence, and then somebody says, well, actually, there's one in the raid at the moment. I think one who wasn't on Ventrilo at that point. And in fact, my wife tells me, it was their lead tank. So it was one of the couple of most important people in the group. And so he said, who? And the answer was, that's not my secret. But I thought that was intriguing. You're sort of suggesting the way you're getting interactions when you're guessing people's. It would be sort of interesting if you were really wanted to study that, to compare interactions in raids that are and are not on Ventrilo. Because if, I don't know how many people have done World of Warcraft, but basically the default arrangement in World of Warcraft is you communicate by typing. However, there are several alternative programs designed to work with World of Warcraft where you can speak and your computer's mic picks it up and their computer speaker reproduces it. So in effect, everybody who's on Ventrilo is in effect in the same room speaking to each other. And of course, if you're in the same room speaking to each other, you know who's male and who's female because voices are noticeably different. Whereas if you're not, you don't. And I wonder if anybody has thought of studying the differences between the dynamics of groups that are or not on Ventrilo in terms of whether or not people, you know, do men treat women differently if they know they're women, so to speak? Or if they think they're women but don't know, and so forth. So that would be sort of an intriguing, not research I'm going to do, but intriguing piece of research. But similar to the same thing happened with age, that I'm sort of curious as to people who interact with me on World of Warcraft how old they think I am. Because one of my characters, I would have guessed people would think was young, because he doesn't take anything very seriously. On the other hand, this is the character who only speaks in rhymed verse. And speaking, in this case, typing. And it's been suggested to me that people would not expect a 20-year-old to be able to pull that off. I'm pretty good at improvising verses, it turns out. So I don't really know what people think, but I've wondered about, you know, when interacting with people, not just in World of Warcraft, but online in general, what assumptions. And I was once, there used to be a very active Usenet news group for people who have participated in the Society of Creative Anachronism, the historical recreation medieval group I've been a long-term part of. And at one point, someone suggested as a game having people on the group post descriptions of other people on the group they hadn't met. Turned out I was 6 feet tall. And that was sort of amusing. I think with gray hair, but I'm not sure. And I probably didn't have gray hair then. That was 15 years ago or 20 years ago or something. But presumably something about how I came across in online personality signaled features quite different from my physical appearance. And I've in fact wondered if both I and my father were able to get away with being more sort of verbally and intellectually aggressive without offending people, because we're both very short. If there's a sense in which people are programmed to think of big people as threatening and small people as not threatening. And so if a big person says, you are wrong for the following reason, that's really upsetting. Small person says it is not so upsetting. That sort of somewhere in your hindbrain it says yes, but he can't pick me up and make me do things. So I'm not sure if that's right, but it's a speculation that's occurred to me. Let me go back to a point that I think you were raising that I actually had on my outline for later about cryonic suspension, and that's what I think of as the non-biological risks. As you were also raising it, that the ways in which you might regret it afterwards. And there are a bunch of them, sort of at the simplest level, at the point when you went under, your assets were $1.5 million. You said, that's great, it'll earn interest while I'm waiting. Turns out that at some point between, there was a hyperinflation or confiscation or something happened, the bank failed. Somewhere there's a science fiction story along these lines. I think it's suspension. I'm not sure. It's a joke, as it were. But, you know, the person has checked, you know, what are my assets? $6 million. That's great. He's called the bank up. And then the operator comes on the line and says, all right, that'll be $100,000 for the next 6 minutes. And he realizes what's happened, obviously. $6 million isn't worth very much. But you can then think of grimmer versions. There's one story in which it's a little more complicated than suspension, but it's, that'll do for the moment, in which he's revived in an overpopulated and very oppressive society, and they basically say, look, here is what we're going to do with you, and if you don't like it, we'll scrap you and revive somebody else. And, you know, tough luck. And they end up, it's some set of testing, but he ends up being assigned to be the pilot of an exploratory spaceship, which is going to be a one-man spaceship for the rest of his life. I mean, that's it. And they've got a schedule for him. And once he's launched on his way to the next star, which is going to take like 6 years or something, he promptly scraps their schedule. He has no loyalty at all to these people and decides what he's going to do and basically tells them to go to hell. Which is sort of a satisfying ending in that particular story. Yeah.
All these scenarios, even if it's perfect, it's not the life that you have.
Yeah.
Isn't the alternative you did?
That's the argument. That's the argument for taking the chance. But I think you can imagine outcomes grim enough. There are, after all, circumstances when people do kill themselves. So you could imagine outcomes grim enough so you would say it was a mistake, and they might not let you kill yourself at that point, right? There are science fiction. There are a lot of these things have been covered in science fiction stories, and sometimes in scary ways as well as not scary ways. Yeah. All right. I guess we're out of time, but I hope you have enjoyed thinking about this sort of odd set of questions, and you may face them. That is, you do face one of them. You could sign up with Calcor, assuming you've got their price, whatever it is at the moment, and you may have the other ones at some point in the